With that, we're going to move on to the next module, PowerShell Essentials for Pentesters. We do not have time at all, not just today, this time, but ever, to talk about PowerShell Essentials in general. So if you're not familiar with PowerShells at all, you should be. We are mainly focused on the concept of post-exploitation. What are we going to do with it? Well, we're going to maliciously manage machines. So we're going to use Microsoft's task management, and some people even have that in their HackerCon talks, that the subtitle is Microsoft's post-exploitation language. You know, it's that powerful. It's not just for management, it's also for malicious management. But the overall goal is like post-exploitation can mean everything but initial exploitation. So let's say you've got a foothold, that's all that means. We're not doing remote exploits so much with post-exploitation frameworks. We're doing lateral movement. We're doing stealing of stuff. We're not doing initial foothold things. There's a lot of frameworks out there. If you didn't get a chance to catch George's C2 Matrix webcast that was out a couple weeks ago, he's done a couple of them now. He has a long list of some of the different command and control frameworks that you may recognize some of them. I've got some listed here. Personal favorites, of course, Metasploit for historical reasons. Empire I love so much, not just because it's PowerShell. I like the way it's built simply. I can go in and hack through it. Very much a big fan of that. Commercial utilities as well. Just doesn't matter what it is, any framework would really be able to do most of what you need. And like most people say, it's how you use the tool here that's important. With PowerShell being the standard task language that Microsoft created over 10 years ago for Microsoft and other non-Microsoft products is their goal, it makes sense to have it somewhat supported in whatever attack framework you have. Even if you're not talking about attacking with it, you will want to attack it because it's what's managing the things we're attacking, right? So we want to be able to speak PowerShell in some way. One of the reasons I like to speak from PowerShell as an attack is I get use of COM, .NET, and any other Windows APIs I can do some form of access with. Even non-standard Windows APIs. If it's in a DLL, I can get it into PowerShell. Even if it's not managed code. It's maybe a little messy, but I can still do it. Why PowerShell instead of a different language for attack tools? It is already has Microsoft's support. So why not go with it? Yeah, I could do my own Python-based attack framework, but if I do it in PowerShell, it's already got most of the functionality I need. There's only a few things that I find harder to do in PowerShell than in an alternative. One of them is firewall rules. I find it to be annoyingly complex in PowerShell. You have to create an object of a rule and then actually assign it. It's like four different lines where NetSH is one line. It's kind of annoying, in my opinion. Also, sending keystrokes to an application. It's a little easier to do it in Visual Basic than doing the .NET way, which is what PowerShell would use, the .NET way. So there's a couple of those items, but for the most part, it's easier. It's not just a clever name. There's a lot of power in PowerShell. Really, though, it's not the PowerShell interface. Some people think about it being the shell. It literally has shell in the name. But when most people say PowerShell, I'm talking about InfoSec, what do they care about? Is that system.management.automation.dll. That's where all the good stuff happens. That's really the important bits. Not just the, what does the window look like? PowerShell.exe interpreter. It's doing the actual work. Now, since version 2 is the most common by install standards, because Windows 7 is so prolific and Server 2008 so prolific, it's closely getting, you know, assumed that version 2 is not going to be the default. Microsoft has deprecated version 2. They, for best practices reason, advise everyone to remove it from your Windows machines and go with version 5. But we still see version 2 is the most common because there's not like a Windows update you can accept that will upgrade your PowerShell version to version 5. You have to do that on your own. You have to do that separately. We could supply our own console, or we can have it scripted and something else that would interface with that DLL. If you've not done any PowerShell before, some advice. Read through, click carefully the appendix, both appendices that we have on this book. They're about one PowerShell in general, one's about PowerShell and management. And you can also look at, Microsoft has a two-part video. It's what you're looking for is what's new in PowerShell version 3 is what the title is. But just look for PowerShell, MSVA PowerShell, and you'll get either the first half or the second half of that article first. And that's the one you want to watch. Because what Jeffrey Snover and one of the Dons does is they say, here's what's new in PowerShell version 3. Here's how we do something. And what problems does it solve? Well, in version 2, we had to do it this way. If you're not doing any PowerShell, it's the best mix of the nice way to do it and then the hackish way to try to do some of the old stuff on Windows 7, because they just installed Windows 7 and all you can hack with is on your victim is the PowerShell that was already installed. So that's my advice on that. There's a few other things I like to highlight as far as using it as an attack tool. This is one of the reasons. We'll be using a script very similar to this. This is a slightly old version of a PDF generating script I made in PowerShell that I always use for phishing. It uses this PDF Sharp library DLL that knows everything you need to know is building most PDFs. It can build, images, different kinds of catalogs and other structures a PDF has in internals. It can do a lot of things for you. Now, yes, I can use any PDF platform that write PDFs. Why do I like to use it with PowerShell? Because I can do something coming up on the next slide. The real magic here is this first line. This is the older way to load a DLL into a PowerShell run space. There are newer ways, like using reflection to map it into memory instead of doing it this way. This is the version 2 way to do it. It does work. But what we're doing is we're doing a phishing proof of concept. Let's say I have a PDF that I make with a tool like this. My point is it's a few more lines than this, but it's not a whole lot of lines to make a PDF. The real goal, though, isn't just I have yet another way to make PDFs. The real goal is I can combine it with other tools in the PowerShell way. So I can use something like what we have at the bottom of here. I can take advantage of the scalability of PowerShell. Here, I have my own PowerShell script, which I haven't shown you, called getVictim. What does it do? It outports custom objects, which is really just a list of attributes in this case, but it's all the victims I've gotten so far. Hostname or IP address, username, password, and port. And I have this script I use, and what I do is as I get more access, my script is going to return more of those objects. The point is, whatever it is, I don't have to know what it is, but I pass it down this pipeline. With PowerShell, that pipe is not like your standard out pipe. It's an object pipe. So it passes objects, not just output, not just standard out. So all these victim objects, think of it as representing each host access I have, each footprint I have, get every share that I can reach with that access. For every share I can reach, get child item. That's a directory recursion with this recurse option anyway. Get every child item that ends with the name of PDF and pass it to my modified merge PDF script. It's going to add a Trojan page to every PDF it finds. So the point of this is, why do I like PowerShell? Because I can use this pipelining. I can rerun it. If I get a new victim or I get a new share or a new directory, I rerun the whole thing and it just automatically goes through everything. So I really like the scalability there. It's a huge value in using PowerShell as an attack tool. You also have native support with other platforms, not just about Windows, but like VMware, for example, loves PowerShell. PowerCLI, the VMware command line that they have for virtual infrastructure, is very, very powerful, literally. We can do a lot with it. I've also been doing things like querying temperature sensors using CIM, the sequel to WMI. It's basically Windows Management Instrumentation, but for other devices. Microsoft generalized it and said, here, everyone else use our standard. And some people accepted that. But using that, querying things like thermostats, I've done with PowerShell as well. Lots of great support from vendors. You have some alternatives too. What if we, in the previous example, had PowerShell DC blocked somehow? What could you do? Microsoft does package a script editor, the ISE, with PowerShell. So you can run that if you're running desktop access. It's not as great for scripts that are running in a shell only, not on a desktop, but you might be able to find that useful. I've also found myself in situations where I end up running, like maybe PowerShell EXE is blocked in the normal Windows System 32, Windows PowerShell V1 directory is where it is. If that is blocked, I could maybe do the 32-bit version by going to the SysWow 6.4 path. That's our 64-bit Windows feature that is the 32-bit Windows that comes with our 64-bit. So everyone's got that clear, right? That the 32-bit version of Windows is in the SysWow 6.4 folder. The 64 bits in the System 32, and the System 1 is just 16-bit. Everyone's got that straight? It really doesn't make sense. Unless you start to think about how Microsoft's like, well, if an application is completely unaware of 64-bitness, then we'll let it go to the Windows System 32 directory that's already hard-coded, and if it doesn't need 64-bit, we can shim in basically like a hook. One of the first things in the 64-bit version redirects to SysWow 6.4, which is Windows on Windows, the WoW part, 32-bit version. But yes, 64 is in the directory of the 32-bit version, in the name of the directory. Very confusing. But we could do that just because the other one was blocked. And then if you ever want to go back to the 64-bit version, because maybe there's something 32-bit can't do, I can't think of anything, but maybe there's something it can't do, well, you can use the sysnative directory and go back to the real one. But back to what we were talking about earlier, we can step over restrictions by just finding alternatives. I can even bring my own console. Ben 10 had this one called Not PowerShell. Start blocking PowerShell exe? Well, he compiled his own terminal shell called Not PowerShell.exe. So when you're blocking PowerShell, you're not blocking Not PowerShell. So kind of a bad pun on that, but that was the idea. You can kind of hear it mentioned as unmanaged PowerShell because it's not part of the Windows distribution. My personal favorite, though, is Jared Haidt's PS Attack. PS Attack, if you've not used it, is another PowerShell console you can get, but it comes bundled with encrypted versions of all your favorite PowerShell scripts, like Invoke Mimikatz. Mimikatz in the form of a PowerShell script is already preloaded. You can build your own with the PS Attack build tool. And when you run the build tool, it creates a random encryption key, puts those things in memory, and decrypts them on demand. So I don't have any antivirus detections at all whatsoever using PS Attack build tool. Not had a problem ever. I don't bother with using Shelter or any kind of ghost writing to go through and manipulate something. I just have to run a different PowerShell. It's not a problem. Under the hood, what's happening? Task automation stuff from Microsoft. The other thing, well, they haven't blacklisted my application because it's custom. Now, the future is application whitelisting, right? Only allow the things I'm allowed to run, and that's why we have all those nested command things, because now I can make something that's allowed to run my thing. So this is tying together, right? So we have those options. As far as attacking PowerShell too, I love to point out, you know, tit for tat, attack and defense. The thing I can take advantage of as a penetration tester is when a defender is going to run PowerShell, there's a PowerShell command precedence. And this is something I pieced together that I found by observational. There's not just a Microsoft document that lists this out. Some of it in pieces, but this is what I found. First thing when you run a command in a prompt, a PowerShell prompt, what happens? It actually looks to see if there's a DOSKey alias. Now, if you have readline enabled, which is something Microsoft added after PowerShell version 3, well, at version 3 they added it, not after, it doesn't work. You have to unload that module. So I would have to unload it first, and then, from then on, the DOSKey alias is the first thing that works. Or was version 2, it's the DOSKey alias. And so maybe remember what DOSKey aliases are. They're macros is the formal name. But like on Linux, you can alias SL to LS. Every time you type it backwards, it does LS, right? Or DIR LS alias. Well, you could do that with DOSKey for command.com or any other shell. It's just not something we think about anymore because we have tab completion. We have command history on our Windows shells, but that was all extensions. That was in DOSKey originally. Now it's part of our normal experience, but you can use the macro feature, not to be confused with VBA macros we'll talk about later, for Word and Office products. You could use that. That's the first thing that happens. Then there is a built-in alias stuff for PowerShell because Jeff Snover and many other folks working on PowerShell when they created it decided that, you know what, we should really make this as bash-friendly as possible because that's where we used to sysadmin. We used to do a lot of things that wasn't just Windows. So we should have alias functionality. We should have that built in. So then if there isn't a DOSKey binding for that, it will check a actual alias created in PowerShell. If there's not an alias for the command that you just ran, then it checks, is there a function that's defined? This could be a couple of different things. For most people, a commandlet and a function are interchangeable, but they're technically a little different. But it checks functions first, then it checks a commandlet. If there's still not something, basically if there's conflicts, it will check overloaded commandlets. So different parameters might be a different one. There's some subtle manipulations we might be able to play with that. But more importantly, if it can't find a commandlet at all, then it'll try for every directory in the path that Microsoft has defined, every path extension as well. So it'll look for, by typing blah, it'll look through all these lists, gets to executable, it'll try blah.bat, blah.exe, blah.cmd, blah.com, blah.sln or whatever, sct. I'm trying to remember the other built-in command line extensions for executables. But it goes through that for every directory in the path. If I, as the attacker, can get somewhere earlier than the legitimate one, I can make the attacker run something rootkit style that's going to hide what I'm doing, or I can steal credentials or something else from that, is the idea. So this is the order of precedence. Now, even if it's a script and not an interactive shell, it still follows the same interpretive order. So you might be able to find something that you could Trojan in when an existing PowerShell script runs. Maybe there's a backup job or some other scheduled task that runs with privileges, and you might be able to hijack it and inject some commands in its sequence. So where do we look for things? C colon backslash scripts is the ipso de facto standard. Every time somebody looks at Stack Overflow for how do I do something in PowerShell, it puts it in C colon backslash scripts. The scripting guys blog, they put it in C colon backslash scripts. So always look there. It's not built by default, but most people use that directory because typing this gets painful. The canonical location, the user's home directory, documents, Windows PowerShell, that's a lot of keystrokes. So we don't see that used too much, but it is informal documentation. Then there's also the system-wide home directory, PowerShell home. We have Windows PowerShell v1.0. This is a directory standard. This is the same as the version of PowerShell that you're running, like version 2, version 5 I've been mentioning. That's just always 1.0 so far. Anything you find, though, examine those scripts. You're going to find hard-coded usernames and passwords. You're going to find other scary things. You might even be able to see things you can take advantage of, like DLLs. So I'm going to pull up a real-world example here of what to look for. There's some scripts I use in some of my lab. If I can get to my lab, let me open up a browser. So I'm just logging into an example machine I have that does some PowerShell automation. I want to show you the kinds of things you're looking for. So right away, I mean, say I've broken a desktop or whatever, I see some shortcuts, there's that. But like I was saying, look at the scripts folder. Let's do that real quickly. I don't know why I'm looking over my shoulder. It's right in front of me. But you see all these scripts. Start looking for them for something of interest here. Hey, the one that says auth, that sounds pretty cool. Let me look at the one that has guac auth in the file name. So what we're pilfering right now for post-exploitation. We're looking for intelligence, other targets. We're also looking for passwords that we see. We see there's some functions defined. I'm going to do a quick little find for the word pass. Oh, and there's a comment. It's literally already on the screen. Secure password equals convert to secure string password. This is really common that you see that. Now, even if that's not even legitimate, this one's commented out, so it might not be any valid anymore. I sure hope it isn't because I'm showing everybody it. But you see this creds equals new object system management PS credential? Well, it's actually creating this and a password. The other thing you'll see is this, the line that's underneath it. The secure string, I guess, is probably the one that illustrates better. Basically, see how this password is actually retrieved instead of from hard-coded, which you find. It's retrieved from this VC cred file. So let's look at that one. VC. It's saved in this encrypted format. So it's protected, right? Well, it's just like hard-coding the password. It's still, the script has to run automatically. So I don't know what the password is anymore, but I can sure write a malicious script that does the same thing, grabs the password from there and magically uses it as this user. That's all I need. As this user, I can still make a malicious script that grabs those creds even though it's not hard-coded in the script anymore. That's the kind of thing you're looking for. Creds. Literally, the convert to secure string is probably the most common one I encounter. Something that I wanted to point out, I forgot to at the last break, some of those real-world things with the encryption. So I pulled up something from a report we did. This was, we were doing, it was related to a stalker case on a campus, a university campus, and we were testing the new security system they added. These were Schlage locks that were mostly wired, but there were a few doors that were wireless, and we were assessing all that stuff. When it comes down to doing things like encryption, though, like we were saying, we don't have to know what it's doing, but when they promise that, hey, yeah, it's encrypted, you don't have anything to worry about, this is the door opening. Or no, this is the card swipe, excuse me. The waveform looks like this. And then the one beneath is the door opening. The card swipes up top with a bad key card. The door opening is this waveform. Well, how different is it? If you start looking at, you know, again, graphically trying to remember like encryption, what's different? This is encrypted, but how much of it is different? So, you have to ask yourself then, if this is the waveform, we used a Yardstick 1 to do the recording. It was a 1 gigahertz, 900 megahertz-ish of a frequency. There's a few things you see might be different, but, you know, except for this portion here, this is the portion that's different. You know, just a, I don't know, 1/6 of the waveform was unique between some random function of card swipe with a bad card, like from the hotel, on the key system, which shouldn't have worked at all. And then the other one was the door opening. Also, too, we were able to replay this one, the door opening, after recording it. We played it over and over again, so it looked like somebody else kept going in. And so they were saying, gee, the vendor says this is an encrypted solution, that the logs are protected because it has the encrypted information, blah, blah, blah. But we're able to replay something. Even though it's encrypted, we can still replay it, right? So just wanted to reiterate that this isn't just, you know, the theoretical, it's the practical. How is it implemented? You don't have to, we had no idea what this means, but we could definitely say, if what happens if I replay it again? Yep, it's showing that you're opening the door multiple times. Nope, we're not. I could record anybody going through the door and frame them for something, you know, because it would show them they were the ones who actually entered the building that time. By playing the message from the lock. The door wouldn't actually open. I want to be very clear about that. We didn't actually break in. We were able to frame other people for breaking in. That was still, you know, a good finding. So, real world, not knowing what we're looking at and realizing they didn't want us, didn't hire us the amount of time we needed to reverse engineer a protocol that was commercially protected. Didn't want to get into DMCA type issues anyway. But, you know, the issue was replayability, and that is not unique. So I wanted to point that out because the conversation came up during lunch, and I forgot to after the last break. So back to slides. We have a lot of exercises coming up, so We'll get there. The next couple of exercises are really one exercise stretched a little bit. We were talking about what we were pilfering. I showed you a real-world example of those things. Again, might not be able to remove that script or that cred.txt file because it's encrypted with something that's a derivative of the user's password hash that created it. So I probably can't move that thing, but I can sure make another malicious script and run it from there that accesses that file. It will work. So that's the kind of thing we're looking for. Look in scripts, look in other directories. We might be able to see something that's a scheduled task running, but we're looking for command injections, DLL injections, or anything else that might be something that gives us better access of some kind. Besides the script directories and home directories, a PowerShell also uses a profile file. Depending upon how it's started, PowerShell will look for its profile in different places. So if I am, for example, on the desktop starting a command shell prompt of PowerShell, it's going to look in my own personal home directory under Documents, Windows PowerShell, Profile to PS1, and if that file exists, it will run anything in that file before I get a prompt. So we want to steal things if that exists because there's something of value there. Maybe it's auto-connect to vSphere Center Server, or it's connect to the Exchange Server, or it's something. Maybe it's just defining modules that the Defender administrator uses, and that would tell us more about the environment they're protecting, what there is to steal. Also, if I put in those malicious commands earlier in that chain of precedence that we mentioned, like as an alias, if I put in the profile a command that creates a new alias, then I could redirect their execution when the time comes. So there's different combinations of files that might be tried. It's so funny there's so many different ones of these, but depending on how it's invoked over the network or the ISE editor or other situations, it may run a different profile file, and I'll have to look for that if I want to steal everything possible or take advantage of new information. Another thing to keep in mind for persistence, I love this example because I'm using it more and more. I'll take whatever cloud provider the organization is using, place my malicious toolkit in their cloud drive, and how do I do that? I invite them to share my drive, my attack drive, my malicious one. I use as a throwaway Google account, let's say. I sign up for the whatever they're using. Here we're using OneDrive. It could be Dropbox or anything else. But you invite them to share that file or that folder, and then it's in their cloud drive. Well, the cloud drives don't really get the same scrutiny when it comes to antivirus detection for performance reasons. And if the file's open, it can't be synchronized as easily. So I like hiding stuff in cloud drives. One, because sometimes the AV doesn't look at it as aggressively, the antivirus. As well as if I want to update my own infrastructure as the attacker, I do it in one place, and then everything else gets that drive, right? So it's a great persistence module. And in PowerShell version 3, I can actually make it always load PowerShell modules from this path. The user doesn't have to say load the PowerShell module. I can make it always load the module. So this is a great persistence technique, new favorite of mine. So the actual syntax is there if you want to play with that. Another fun item, in PowerShell version 3, Microsoft created the ability to use readline. And if you've ever used that, that's one of the ways you can do fancy terminal tricks like hiding your password or using different color in your text terminal. You can use readline, and it basically, PowerShell will read and execute a PS console host readline function every time there's a line of output on the screen. It did not provide this said function, though. It only hard-coded the fact it would call it for every line. So if I create one of these, either in the path, I can create a file name .bat.cmd.exe, and if there isn't one provided by the system, they can use my malicious one, right? Because I can beat it in that order of precedence we talked about earlier. That started off with version 3. Microsoft did correct that behavior in version 4 moving on. It basically stops processing files for this particular function. But that other command precedence I mentioned still works. So for other functions, I can do that. Also, I can still create an alias that beats out the function. So I can still use that profile file to Trojan this command before it gets ran. The defender doesn't actually run this. Windows does it for them. So lots of ways to make things run. Now, we're going to talk about PowerShell for a little bit in the form of Empire. Empire, I've said it before, favorite tool of mine. Hear a lot of people, especially since August, the announcement from, I think it was Harmjoy that announced it first, one of the original authors, saying, you know what, we're all doing other things. PowerShell, Empire did its job, and we're moving on. We hope somebody forks and maintains it. And other people stood up right away, mainly the BC security guys, saying, already done that, here's our fork. And they improved it and made it better. If you have not had a chance to check out their DEF CON talk from this year, where they explain all the things they fixed in Empire, please check that out on your own time. Lots of great details. It's some really good stuff. It's actually the version of Empire we're using today, is the BC Empire fork. Why is this even an issue, I guess, is one question. I mentioned you may have heard that, but if you haven't, the maintainers announced that we're going to maintain Empire anymore because they feel that they brought enough attention to PowerShell security, they're going to focus on other things. One of the factors in that is most of those developers are being hired and paid to write tools that work with other infrastructure, like Cobalt Strike. And although some of the things we do in PowerShell are really C-sharp things, they're basically focusing mostly on C-sharp because of speed. It's a little faster. It's not that the commands aren't working in PowerShell. It's just faster doing it more natively, a little bit. Depending upon what it is faster than other things. So there's that focus is different. I like to tell people, though, stop and think about this. Microsoft didn't say PowerShell isn't going to work, and the maintainers didn't say it doesn't work or can't work. They said, we're going to focus on other things, but they did say we hope someone else picks it up. And the BC security folks were one of the guys who did. There are other ones out there, but that's the one I've seen have the most interesting updates where they fixed some of the AMSI. They fixed a web server signature. Basically, Empire was one of the only, was the only web app that would have a very specific list of Cypher suites supported and no downgrade opportunity. So if you try to interrogate a PowerShell Empire command and control server and try to negotiate an SSL suite, it will only do one particular combination. And it's the only one that does that combination only. And so it's real easy to identify that it's Empire. Some of the other things it was doing was easy to detect on the other side, on the client side. And the BC security folks have, improved quite a bit in many areas on that. The kinds of things we can do are pretty representative of any command and control environment. We can do things a lot like we can do in Meterpreter in the Metasploit project. We can execute files. We can do directory listings. But we have different context-sensitive menus in Empire. Empire is an asynchronous command and control. So the idea is we have listeners, which are basically a recipe of an endpoint, what to talk to. We can say, hey, use this listener, stager, when the stager is the command that runs, and it will make the agent, which is the process, actively running. The stager is a command that starts the agent. Agent happens to be dynamic running in memory. When the agent connects to something, it's a listener. The thing the listener is connecting to may be even not an Empire server. It could be a Metasploit multi-handler. It can be something else. Those are what we have. All right. Now, no matter what context you're in, we can use info and we can see settings. I will say one of the early gotchas in Empire, if you tried to use it and had problems, is that it's actually written server-side, mostly in Python, on Linux. It is case-sensitive. So when you set a setting, you literally have to make sure that you're using the proper case for everything. Tab completion is your friend in Empire. There's only a couple of situations where tab completion doesn't work exactly correctly, right? Basically with some tab completion of external files, it doesn't work right. It's definitely good for all these settings. the modules are what you actually use to do something interesting for your post-exploitation activities. So some favorites, clipboard monitor. Basically, checking in every 10 seconds, for example, show me what's in the clipboard now. Show me what's in the clipboard now. Show me what's in the clipboard now every 10 seconds. You don't get a full keylogger type on change notification, but it just tells you what's in the clipboard occasionally. And you can speed that up, but I find it's pretty good in the default settings for mostly what I want. Of course, a keylogger is nice. Using Mimikatz is nice. Credentials stored in Microsoft's vault, like saving RDP credentials or website credentials, can in some ways be extracted. It's not that it's only something in Empire. Of course, Metasploit has many of these same features in Meterpreter. I do like to use PS Remoting here. WinRM, Windows Remote Management, gives us, I find, a little bit better control. There's a lot of endpoint security products that detect PSExec now and assume it's malicious in the way PSExec's running. Windows Remoting, PS Remoting, is a little bit more professional, and currently endpoint security is not tagging it from what I found. We can turn on RDP. We can run something as every user, of course. We have something we'll use later, PowerUp, built in from the PowerSploit project, which is going to give us a lot of great escalation suggestions on escalating our privileges. I also like to use the persistence. Here we have elevated and an event log one. I like to also use a non-elevated userland persistence. One of my favorites is setting the idle time to 2 or 3 minutes as the scheduled task. And when there's 2 to 3 minutes of idle time, like the screensaver is going to kick in eventually, it will trigger off another agent. And now I know when it connects back, I didn't do anything. I got a new agent. That's great news, because that means somebody might not be messing with their screen at this particular moment. It's a great chance for me to start snooping around. They probably still have their browser open. This is a big, you know, what if situation. I might be able to poke around in memory and find something more interesting, because they're probably logged in, but they're not actively changing. Maybe they're just, you know, waiting for a phone call or something. We don't know. But I like to have that persistence. I find that's pretty useful. And I also use, I don't use this as often, the network get exploitable system. That looks for your more common remotely exploitable situation, like your classic MS-08067. It'll look for those kinds of situations, just the real easy ones. It doesn't look for a big, long list, just some of the high-profile ones historically. I started to say I like to use Trollsploit, not just to troll the user, but one of the options, Thunderstruck in Trollsploit, opens up an Internet Explorer browser, and by default it'll open up a YouTube URL of Thunderstruck, which is really hilarious now that it usually plays an ad first. Because you don't see it. It's a hidden window. You start hearing your computer advertising to you. And you immediately, what does the user do? They start looking for the tab. Which tab's making that noise? They can't find it. And it's hilarious to me to do that. But more importantly, we can make their browser go somewhere. You can change that URL with the setting, and you can make it go somewhere like to Beef, the browser exploitation framework. But it's a hidden Explorer window. You can see the Explorer process. But you can make it go somewhere with a Trollsploit. And, of course, there's some side effects. It turns the volume, unmutes it first, then turns the volume all the way up periodically, like every 60 seconds or so, it turns the volume all the way back up again. Which, if you're just getting somebody to visit a page, it's less useful, but it's still kind of a funny thing to do. So I love all this stuff about Empire. And although there's more than this, there's nowhere near the amount of modules that are in Metasploit or some of the other frameworks, but I don't find that I use those. These are the ones I use. And if I don't have something I want, what do I use? There's a management one that lets us run any PowerShell. Not just a command, but I can upload a PowerShell script into the memory of the agent that's running, never touches the hard drive, and I can run it dynamically. So I can always modify my agents on the fly. That's probably the thing I like about it the most. You have your tab completion here. Always use that. Very, very useful to find your way. This page here on the quick start, this is the, I should say, the most concise way to start getting somewhere with Empire. I've placed it in the Opt Empire directory on your Kali VM and configured it already for you. You can just run it, go to the listener context, start one of type HTTP. If you don't change the name, which we don't here, it's also named HTTP. This use listener HTTP, though, we're calling it by type. Every time you see HTTP after that, we're calling it by name because we didn't give it a name. It inherited the type. Here, set host to that. I really want to draw some attention. Here I have an IP address, but if you want to be doing this in real life, you would usually use your phishing domain website or something like that, or a public IP address and the public port with a colon port, which is not the same as the port setting for the listeners. The host is where the agent should connect to from the public side. There is a port setting, which we don't show here, that is where you listen to internally what port it would bind to on your local machine. Those are not always the same thing because you might have NAT and port forwarding and stuff. So that's the one of the things I see people make a mistake in the real world. Call us up and say, we need help. We can know something's running, but it's not connecting. Why is this not working? And it's because they got that confused. The execute command will start the listener. Then we pick a generic multi-purpose launcher. That's going to create our stager. We can actually look at that. So I'm going to show you a couple of things under the guise of troubleshooting to get you started because, again, I've seen people do this on their own and get just far enough that they can kind of get a feel for it, but it doesn't quite work right. So out of curiosity, for those of us here, how many people have used PowerShell once or twice and never again? Sorry, not just PowerShell, Empire. Use Empire a couple of times and never again. All right, not a lot of people, but some. I'm used to seeing more people raise their hands. How many people don't raise their hands? Oh, wow. That's the first time that actually worked. Usually people raise their hands just to troll, but nobody raised their hands. That actually made sense. All right. A little late in the afternoon probably for jokes, but like that. Anyway, bad jokes. A few things here on the slides I'm just going to show you instead of doing it, but like this script import that I mentioned, that is the thing I love probably the most about everything. Every tool lets you upload, do directory listings. That's not really the magical part. The real magic is I can just send stuff into memory and execute it without touching it. So, after the delay, I'm just going to show you a few of those commands that you'll be seeing. I want to just highlight again that certain ones of these are because some things are more difficult to troubleshoot. So I'm doing this separately than demonstrating the exercise because real life and exercise are a little different. But you can still take lessons from one. I've got my Windows 10 machine as my victim. I've got my Kali machine here. I'm going to... let's see. Firstly, I will double check my settings. I can still connect to the network. All right, I'm good. So, cancel. There we go. So we'll get into here. Firstly, for troubleshooting, if you ever need to troubleshoot, you can exit Empire and rerun it. And you run it with this debug command line. Minus minus debug. And now in that Empire directory, you see this empire.debug file. This one, if the agent's like having an encryption or decryption process problem, you'll be able to see stuff like that in that file. It's very detailed. You'll have to hunt pretty hard through lots of lines if you're really trying to troubleshoot that. But sometimes I find myself doing that. So that's one of my tips for living with Empire in the real world. Let's go ahead and just get some stuff set up. Listeners, nothing, that's expected error message, nothing active yet. I'm going to use listener and then tab tabs. I'm going to show you my options. Stick with the classic HTTP. I'm going to leave the name, but I'm going to check with info some of those settings. And the only thing I really care too much about is this host line. Since I don't have port forwarding, I want host and the port setting to match. So I'm going to set host to HTTP 10.10.75.99, port 8080. And I'm going to set port to 8080. I want those to match today in the classroom because we're not going between a NAT firewall or have some domain fronting or some other proxy involved or reverse proxy or something. And that's all I need pretty much. I will go ahead and execute that listener. And now I can actually do something with it. So I'm going to go to use Stager and tab tab. What do we have? Let me start with the multi-launcher first. Again, for troubleshooting, I like to keep things relatively simple. So I like to have this pre-made so I can just grab it when necessary. So you might find yourself needing to do this today, especially if you want to learn the most about using the tool and why, you know, these PowerShell-based tools are still not just a fading fad. Fading fad? A faded fad. That they're still alive and well. So multi-launcher. Go. Use Stager. Oh, I'm already in there. Gee. You guys let me type that twice. So now that I'm here, I can do info, look at the settings. A couple of things I do for my troubleshooting tool is I set B64 to false so that if something goes wrong, I can see it. I can actually look at that shellcode. Not for normal exploitation, but just for a general purpose troubleshooting empire agent, Stager, that makes an agent. I'm going to set also, I'm going to leave it for now, safe checks. This safe checks, it'll check for little snitch, a few other things, try to disable some of the restrictions. It adds a couple thousand bytes of characters to the agent, which all show up on the command line. A lot of things can go badly when you have a couple of thousand bytes in your command. One thing, they don't like to run well on XP and Server 2003. It's too many bytes. It literally cannot process a command that long. It also is a dead giveaway. It's evil. Because if something's that big and it's normal automation, it's usually a script, not a single command. So you could disable that if you're trying to be sneaky, but I'm going to leave it there so we can actually see it. Set listener to the only one I have. Just tab completing. I'm going to set output file to opt Empire downloads. I'm going to call it launcher.ps1, and I'm going to generate and leave the rest of the defaults. So now it created that. Now in that location where I put it, loads, I chose this directory because as I use agents for things, there's going to be a directory for each agent by its name. And anything that it did, like an agent log, is going to be inside of that folder. So I like to use this directory as a temporary holding place, like an intermediate staging area when I'm doing the attack. And what I'll do is I'll run like a Python server. Python 3, we go http.server, and the port number we want to listen on. I said server. I knew that. Serve.http. Brains backwards. Serve HTTP. All right, help me. It's what? Oh, the dash M, their module. And did I get it? And now my brain Swiss cheese. There we go. Problem with tab completion is you really don't memorize anything. You just tab your way through it. All right. And then where you don't do that, you script it. All right. So now I have a generic HTTP server running there. If you haven't used this before, super handy to have a generic file transfer. What I'm going to do now, again, I'm not pretending to be the victim completely. I'm just troubleshooting that I have everything set up the way I expect. Because if I had a certificate, if I had a domain name, you want to make sure this works before you send out your phishing attack, right? So that's what we're talking about here. You could download with that web interface. Like if I go to that machine, 10.10.75.99, port 3000. And now, of course, I Googled it. I didn't just type the whole URL. So I'll get there a little faster. I can see any of those files. It's just much easier to do that transport when I want. Now, also too, I can do, I'm going to start PowerShell. I'm typing in ISE, which is the integrated alias for the ISE editor. And I'm going to do that same trick with Notepad. I'm going to open and type in http://, and type in that URL of 10.10.75.99 port 3000 launcher.ps1. It downloads the file, puts it in the editor, and now I can see it. If I zoom out, I can see what that code is. I turn off the Base64 encoding. Otherwise, I would see PowerShell minus enc for encode and a few other PowerShell command lines like nop and minus W1 for a hidden window and some things. But if I wanted to troubleshoot something's wrong with PowerShell or antivirus is detecting it, this is the best view because I can run this script by pressing the run script button. And if there's an error message, it shows up. It doesn't just go somewhere off standard out that I'm not looking at. I can actually see it if there's an error. Plus, this is a debugger. I could actually go to every semicolon and separate these lines out and step through each line if I wanted to of what this does. Maybe I'm trying to find something because it's broken. You see how it's doing some string concatenation? That's some very minor obfuscation that the BC Empire guys were a little more aggressive at than the original. Just some minor stuff to do it. Here we see a bypass of AMSI by literally using AMSI utils from PowerShell. We're calling it to disable AMSI in PowerShell. It's just funny. So we see some things. See the fake user agent. Somewhere we'll see our IP address. In the BC fork, it does do a Base64 encoding of your IP address. So you have to look for a Base64 version. This, we had the little, I just moused on the wrong part. Like we showed earlier, the Python XORing for encryption use, the little code snippet we looked at. If you want to look at the PowerShell equivalent, this is what you want. Here, we're using an AES key to decrypt stuff from the server. And that's what the session key is used for in Empire. So anyway, we can go through that. This, I believe, is the actual destination URL. Yep, because it also shows it the fake location. So now if I run this, I have something, I can work with. Oh, unable to save because it's in the temporary directory. I have to save as, and I'll put it in scripts with everything else. It'll look just like everything else. Launcher PS1. Now I can run it. And if it looks like it's hanging, that's good because it's running. It's supposed to be running. Yes, you had a question. I could have probably done that. I can copy and paste it. I can do other things. I like doing it this way because again, I can break it out. I can change it and just play and run it again. If I start tweaking it, I probably should be saving it. So that's why I did the file save as. It'll automatically resave it every time I run the script once I do that. Yeah. So we see it's not dying. There's no error messages. And if we come back here, this is the, when I was playing around with it, not the actual agent. But we do see an agent here, and I can play around with that one, right? So at this point, I can start doing some of those fun things. I'll come back and finish that demonstration later, but I want to just kind of give you a little bit of feel for that before we got too much further, because I want to talk about what we can do with it, not just the tool itself. The point is, what can we do with it? I mentioned that we have a Mimikatz command. Well, that is really just running the invoke Mimikatz PowerShell script. If you have to modify your Empire ever, usually it's you're updating Mimikatz. You're grabbing the latest DLL version of Mimikatz, Base64 encoding that, copying it over the old one, and now you've got the latest Mimikatz ready to go. Just doing a git update of the Empire system is new, maybe 3 months old typically. It's gotten a lot better. It used to be about a year old, but maybe 3 months old, a version of Mimikatz before somebody gets around to updating it. We'll see how that changes here in the future. But I can upload, download, I can steal, I can do everything I want. I mentioned BC Security. They created the fork we're using. They really should read their DEF CON talk about disabling some things, making stuff better. Really can't give them enough credit about making things, taking something that was pretty good proof of concept wise and making it like professional quality. They really took it to the next level. I mean, they deleted other coding errors like duplicate HTTP headers. That was another telltale giveaway that you were using Empire, because it had some HTTP headers duplicated. That's not normal. and some other general improvements. But still, I find it important enough, I have to point this out and spend half a slide on it. You know, why are we still focused on PowerShell so much and Empire? Well, all Empire is a download cradle that lets you run PowerShell. And PowerShell is Microsoft's task management language. It is not going away. If antivirus starts blocking anything that we have, there's a million other ways we can do it. Those string concatenations, for example, with the plus sign, that is all you have to do to get around those problems, which we'll see in an exercise coming up. All right? Part of it is, too, I like to be able to very quickly, this happened in September, Microsoft changed the way the MSI bypass was detecting certain things because of success of tools like this, and it was so easy to come in there and just move that plus sign over, and now it doesn't get detected. It was that simple. It's going to be one of those problems where if they're always chasing a known bad with signatures, we can change what we're doing very simply. And if it's in text, I don't have to worry about recompiling and doing other things. It's easier in a script for me. I still like to compile and use shellcode. Don't get me wrong. I love that. That's a lot of fun. But if I'm just getting a job done, I'm doing it the Microsoft way when I'm using PowerShell. So one of the reasons I like Empire over most other command and control tools is because I can manage things the way Microsoft intended, just a little more maliciously. If I use a tool like Covenant, which I also like, I'm using C#, which is also a Microsoft way. It's just a little more, less mature, and therefore a little more obvious that it's an attack framework instead of a normal Microsoft technology application. All right? Generally speaking, though, what kinds of things can go wrong? Well, not getting the right IP address, like not public versus IP address, that kind of a problem, the wrong port. Of course, keep in mind those connections are asynchronous, so by default, it's every 5 seconds that an agent will check in with a listener. So if you tell it to do something, here run this command, it may be 5 seconds before it even knows that you've done anything, and then it's going to check in later 5 seconds after that. So you've got at least 10 seconds. If the command didn't take a long time to run, you've got 10 seconds before it comes back with any output. So don't panic, especially in the classroom. Nothing happened in 10 seconds. Wait at least 10 seconds. That's just the way it is. You can change that timing, but more aggressive than 5 seconds probably isn't a good idea. If things don't work, you can try to nudge it a little bit. I like to do the PWD command. Very innocuous, right? Print the working directory. I'm going to have one of those. And it's going to be simple. If I get a response, I haven't lost the agent. It's just there was no more output to the commands that I was waiting for. It just didn't give me any output. You ever been in that situation where you had a backdoor shell and you didn't realize you'd do like an ls of a directory that had no files in it and you thought it was broken because there's no files and didn't print anything out? Never happened to anybody? Just me, I guess. Okay. Nudge it with something like PWD. It might be that malware or other defense has caught on and start blocking it where it wasn't initially. I've had that happen a few times, not as common, but it's possible. I've also found that certain stages work better than others for some things. For example, if I use like an HTA delivery, then it is an HTML entity. It is, again, processed by some of the lower security postured processing. Like a web browser would be doing things. Maybe it's, if I can deliver it a different way, I might get a little bit better privileges, or just different privileges. Maybe it's purely something simple as a escaping or other obfuscation thing. I've been in situations too where just regenerating the same VBA script, if you're doing an HTA or the VBA for inside of a Word doc, for example, that there's a name collision on a reserved keyword. And if I just make the stager again, the randomness of the variable names works out. So sometimes you still have to just try harder. Just try it again. I've also been in the situation where time skew can really affect. If your victim's time clock is way off from yours, and it's not doing a good job of sorting out time zone differences, it will, by default, just ignore things thinking it's already seen that command because the time skew was off. So sometimes in the classroom, that happens a lot more than in the real world where everything's synced. So don't be surprised if that happens. I've made a couple of tweaks where that shouldn't be a big problem, but it does happen in the real world, so I'll mention that. I mentioned the rest of these. You've got that debug flag. I can look at using my own test. You can even play with some PowerShell commands to see what it would look like to download it. Is there an IPS detecting it? You can try to break this down and see what's there. Also, too, if you really have been customizing things and screwed up stuff, like settings, you can reset everything with this script. It will zero out the database and start completely over with what you have. Here, I've already done this for you. I typed that, demonstrated that already on 139. I did not the Python 2, I did the Python 3, but same idea to serve it up. Great intermediate staging. You can, if you try hard enough, actually serve up files from Empire itself, arbitrary files. But I don't know, I have a better mental process personally when I know it's a separate staging area. It's just worked better for me. Some of those utilities, like I mentioned, PowerUp, came from PowerSploit or other frameworks. Since Empire was the leading PowerShell project for the last three years, once somebody came up with something interesting with PowerShell, it got ported into Empire almost immediately. If it wasn't, it was because there was a pretty good alternative already in there, or it really wasn't that big of a deal. You could easily do that import command I mentioned to load more PowerShell commands into there. The Ninja Copy is one of those, like it sounds, copying a file, bypassing the permissions and not getting logged as well. Book Mimikatz we mentioned, credential injection, some other utilities are all there, originally in PowerSploit, but still part of Empire. I almost never use those independently. They were developed independently and part of a different project by design, but they're always, I should always use them from there. Some other honorable mention things as well. The Nisheng framework is pretty sweet. It's a PowerShell-based attack framework, a little more designed to be like Metasploit, but if Metasploit, all of Metasploit, not just Meterpreter, would be on the victim, is kind of the way you would do this. You can use Nisheng as a PowerPreter, which is basically like the Meterpreter, but in PowerShell. It brings everything with it. It's like bringing MSF console with your Meterpreter, if you don't think of it that way. It's much more easier to pivot and move laterally if I'm literally from that point moving forward. I don't have to relay through my agents. I can just start it from there. Also, I really like the OutExcel and other payload options. Like MSF Venom, for example, you have to take the MSF Venom output, the VBA, Visual Basic for Applications script, and paste that into a spreadsheet using Excel or something. Here, it actually builds you an Excel spreadsheet, the whole file, which is, you know, a lot less of a headache clicking on stuff to open it up. It's just, I don't know. If we can automate so much, why are we're making cool shell code. Do I really have to open up Excel and paste it in, really? Why don't I have a computer do that for me? So I like that we can do that here as well. Keep in mind, too, that some of the things we need to do, if we're maliciously administering a Windows environment, I can do that the same way a normal person would, just with malicious intent. So I might take advantage of everything in Active Directory. I can do some reconnaissance. Favorite example, of course, is Bloodhound. It's going to go through and find relationships between things, mainly looking for opportunities to interact. If I, for example, can get an account that is an admin somewhere, I can see with graph theory in Bloodhound where I can write, what shares, what other machines can I access. Can't stress enough how powerful Bloodhound is. It's actually one of those tools that I find more useful for defenders than attackers. A lot of attackers use it because it is useful. But for all those defenders who don't have proper network documentation, run Bloodhound. It will give you a lot of information about how you're built. And you can go through and clean up old stuff like, wait, that account should be disabled. He's not a domain admin anymore. We don't have that SQL service anymore. We can delete that. Lots of great opportunity with Bloodhound to find those. Other things to keep in mind, although it's not PowerShell exactly, ByteBleeder's CrackMap Exec is pretty amazing. But the tool wins the award for the worst name InfoSec tool. You just kept adding things to this tool. You can call it the Swiss Army Knife for Windows and Active Directory. That's pretty appropriate. But what it was originally was you started playing around with doing like password guessing over the network, called it cracking. PS Exec combined with that, and network mapping and pass the hash was integrating the PS Exec portion. And about that point, he stopped adding letters to the name. But it does a lot of things that Responder does as well, with SMB relaying. There's a lot of great things that it does. So honorable mention there, definitely great to have alternatives when something's not quite working right, something to experiment with on your own. Okay? Especially if I have something like multiple domains and an organization's acquired by another one, merged, or you had somebody set up an old domain controller, set up a new one after they learned how to not do it, but they can't quite get rid of the old stuff, right? They have to build new things, so they trust the relationship between the domains. Something like Bloodhound will show you the relationships. Very, very valuable. Of course, Metasploit has lots of PowerShell-related stuff. You can have PowerShell-style payloads. We can even use this one a lot, the web delivery. I'll use that in combination with phishing to get people to a meterpreter in the form of a PowerShell script. Besides the fact I can hand off back and forth between Empire and Metasploit if I really wanted to, I could do that. I mentioned Mimikatz, some other powerful things to keep in mind, like Mimikittens. How many of us have heard of Mimikittens? Let me back up. Have we all heard of Mimikatz? Okay, I saw enough heads moving. I'm pretty sure everybody who's going to acknowledge that. So Mimikittens, show of hands maybe. It's a little easier to see. Who's heard of Mimikittens before? Two people have heard of Mimikittens. Mimipenguins. Anybody heard of Mimipenguins? It's a thing. No. Invoke, Mimi wildebeests. No? Mimi pandas? That's a new one to me. Well, Mimipenguins is a Linux-based one that tries to grab memory that's in places you can read, where Mimikatz grabs password hashes and cryptext passwords from LSAS mostly. It does other things, but that's the biggest reason most people use it. For Kerberos theme tickets as well as hashes. Well, Mimikittens uses userland debugging to scrape memory without even being admin looking for passwords. So we can take advantage of that. We actually will use that in exercise coming up. But long story short, PowerShell gets automatically an SE debug privilege assigned to it when you're running PowerShell, because .NET framework uses that to do process creation and some other things. So even if you're not an admin with explicit assigned SE debug privilege, like you can run a debugger, you still can be a debugger when you run PowerShell, which is one reason you might see malware doing something in VBA that starts a PowerShell command, because it gets that debug privilege by going via PowerShell. And that's what Invoke Mimikittens takes advantage of. It's actually doing a debugger, a special debugger in C#, .NET, but it does it in PowerShell, because in .NET, you can't be as dynamic, right? I mean, you can, but it actually makes a huge footprint, lots of temporary files, that csc.exe does the compiling of the MSIL, the bytecode for C#. So we have those. There's a few others that might come in handy. The PowerShell suite was something that you may have seen. Carlos Perez, Dark Operator, had some scripts. SubT also had Interceptor. It was kind of a neat idea. Along the lines of yesterday, when we were man-in-the-middling stuff, and we start dealing with HTTPS and SSL strip things, well, if we want to hijack an encrypted connection, we can do it at an endpoint, right? We, if we're truly in the middle, we can remove and add encryption here, right? If we're doing that with a proxy, we can remove and add encryption. With Interceptor, the idea is we're actually going to use PowerShell and the internal Windows API stuff for certificates to dynamically create and sign certificates as you request new HTTPS sites, and it will also eavesdrop on your browser while it's at it. So it's a pretty sluggish, not very responsive, but it's a very fascinating PowerShell script because it man-in-the-middles at one endpoint and dynamically creates certificates, which works really well if you're trying to evade detection by an IPS with a malicious proxy. Interceptor is pretty nice for that. We have also Daniel Bohannon's Invoke Obfuscation. If you've not seen any of his Invoke Obfuscation talks, I highly encourage you to just Google Invoke Obfuscation, and you'll get one of those DerbyCon videos where he shows it, or a different one, but primarily those are what comes up top in the results. And it does literally what I put in this bullet point. I'm really pretty proud of this, I got to say. Uncanonicalizes, which is very, it's like alliteration. It doesn't sound like proper English. Well, no, that's what it does, is it turns things out of its proper form, but still does the job. It uncanonicalizes it, makes it uncanon. Verbs and tokens for PowerShell. Makes it much harder to do detection. All right, so a lot of things there. We've got an exercise coming up. You're going to use the word remotely that you used in the previous exercise and Empire. If you need to start a troubleshooter to troubleshoot your settings, do what I already demonstrated. And we can troubleshoot if necessary. I can come help you. Run the client EX, and that's going to do a couple of things for us in the background. You can look at it. It should also drop some credentials into memory for theft later, and just dive right in. Don't forget, though, to add the port 8080 on the host command. If you look at info, it doesn't show a port because it's defaulting to 80. Just follow the book, and you should be perfectly fine. You'll set that up. Again, you don't necessarily need to troubleshoot from this with base64 set to false. I like to do it that way for my own visibility, but you can just follow the book. You'll be fine in this exercise. This exercise should only take about 15 to 20 minutes, depending upon what you're doing. What I haven't showed you yet is using an HTA. So as I said, I'm going to drop in and show you a couple more things, but I want you to get started and get this HTA generated. And you're also going to use your Windows 10 VM as an attacker to help you create the PDF in the first place, and then it will be a victim at that point. You're going to create it with the same startup script. You're going to need that either the Python 2 or the Python 3 version in another terminal. And again, you don't need to run this one here. This one's for troubleshooting. You don't have to type this. Pay attention to the instructions, please. This is only an alternative way to try to run some things. When you run the client EX batch file, you'll get a shortcut to the ISE editor. Double click on the shortcut. You're going to edit this, change it to your IP address of your Kali VM and the port number you're using, and then it will make this phishing PDF. I'll be demonstrating this too, but I want you to jump in and get started. Once you make the PDF, you can press the run button. You can open up the PDF by browsing Explorer or typing it as on the screenshot. And I want to highlight something here. One of the alerts that thing generates is malicious update required. You know, we don't have to tell the victim it's malicious. But I found trying to reproduce, like, I need to update the font, is too believable, and people don't understand that this is malicious. If I make it look in the classroom too ninja, we have to be more pirate. It has to be more obvious that we're hacking here. I've had people say, so what? That's what it always says. You know, the point is I control that. So we have that message, and then it's going to get the security warning. This is by default Adobe DC Reader install setting. I always uncheck this so I can have the same experience when I come back. But you may notice that the URL stops processing at the colon here. This was one of those weird things that Adobe DC Reader never had. It just assumed if you just do a URL or a host name and not a port number, it prints the whole URL down to the resource, into the resource. But if you put in a colon port number, it stops at the colon. And about a year ago, they patched it, and it started working again. I was like, oh, that was a bummer. It was good while it lasted. About 6 months ago, it happened again. So in the current version of DC Reader, it still happens, where it doesn't show you the full URL. It doesn't, you don't see all the evil. All you have to do is make that host name or IP address look like it's an actual, like a decryption plugin or something, and the user's gonna click through, right? So you're gonna make that, and then you're gonna open it up, and it's gonna open up the HTA again. Yeah, there's a couple of clicks you have to click through as a user, but users will click through anything you prompt them pretty much. And you will get a different randomly named agent. Don't literally type this because you're going to get a different one, right? This is random. You're going to interact and tab complete whatever it is and rename it to something that's easier for you to type. And then you can do something with that. All right? The rest, once you get to this point, what I want you to do is to try to steal those login credentials from the Internet Explorer that the setup script created for you. There is a invoke MimiKittens in this optps directory. I made a few improvements to it. The MimiKittens was written by Jameson O'Reilly, Australian individual, a couple of years ago now, has not maintained or updated it. I added a few things such as stealing TeamViewer credentials from memory. I added a few things like that. I also removed a bunch of things to try to make it faster for the classroom. It takes a long time to run if you run this on everything. Because you're debugging processes and using regular expressions to try to find passwords in memory. And if you do all of the signatures, it takes way too long for the classroom. So I made it smaller. And since we have Kitten Wars as our target website, I made it invoke MimiKitten Wars. See the progression there, right? All right, so invoke MKW, because I'm not typing that much, is the script. You can read through the script if you like, but you're going to script import that. And then you're going to script command to run it, okay? But part of this challenge, again, is to fight your way through the syntax. Use tab completion. Look at the settings with info. That's how you're going to learn more about what you can do with this, all right? You can use the Word VBA macro. You can use the launcher if you have to troubleshoot.